I will call the meeting to order. Representative Detmer and I walked in late together, so he gets to do the minutes if he's ready. April 7th.
Is it still the same as the one I had before?
I don't know yet. There you go, sir.
You know, you don't treat all the members the way, do you? Is that just me, I hope.
Madam Chair, I approve the minutes.
Representative Detmer moves approval of the minutes of April 7th. Any discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion passes and the minutes are approved. Today we have, as you know, our education omnibus bill, and we are going to go through it, have the staff walk us through it. We will take questions at the end of each article, and we've asked them to go fairly fast. And members shouldn't have a lot of questions because these are all things you've all seen before in the policy committee or the K-12 finance committee, and of course we did hear the policy provisions in this committee as well when we heard the policy bill from the policy committee. So this is more a time for the public to know what is in the bill and hear from them. Tomorrow we will be going through the markup and doing the amendments, and that's when members get to say what they like and don't like about the bill via amendments or making statements. But this is our time to get the bill out to the public, walk through it, and then have testimony, and we have 7 people signed up right now. So we will go to first Mr. Crow to go through the spreadsheet, and then we'll have Mr. Strom and Larson go through the bill. So Mr. Crow.
Madam Chair and members, there are 2 spreadsheets in your packet, both aligned horizontally on legal page. One says education finance levies in the upper left-hand corner, and the other says K-12 Finance Division 2009 session appropriation tracking. Let's start with the appropriation tracking spreadsheet. It's fairly simple. You pull that sheet out and look at the 5th column from the right, difference house minus base. That's where you'll kind of see what changes are included in this bill. The 1st column from the right, or the last column on the right, is the difference house from base for the tails. So you can see the impact of changes in the out bienniums. I've also included the February forecast biennial totals and the governor's recommendation on this for your information. On the left side on the program names, you'll see the programs italicized if there's a change item. The exception to that is programs where there are changes because of shifts but not decision items separately in those programs. So for example, on line 33, abatement aid shows a $173,000 reduction, but it's not italicized because that's merely a reflection of the shift change. And so there are some changes that aren't actually separate decision items for you. So if you start on line 14, the first change to the budget, there's actually only 3 major changes in the budget. They are the aid payment shift, the property tax shift, and the federal stabilization funds. So on line 14, you see the aid payment shift. This bill would move us from a 90-10 payment schedule to a 73-27% payment schedule. If you follow that across, you can see that relative to base, that saves $969,372,000 in the house minus base column. And that's the aid payment shift that's only in general education. There's all of these other changes down below are added on top of that. Then on line 15, the property tax shift, included in this bill is a change that increases requires districts to recognize 49.1% of their property tax payments for a given calendar year in the fiscal year that ends in June. As we talked about earlier, usually those property tax payments are recognized for the following fiscal year that starts in July, but this will require them to recognize about half, or 49.1%, in the fiscal year that's just ending. And that allows the state to save payments in the fiscal year that's ending. And in the case of line 15, that total is $604,348,000. Then, as the governor did on line 16, this bill has a advanced payment fund for districts that are in statutory operating debt, allowing them to apply for a payment equal to restoring them back to 90-10 or their amount of negative fund balance, whichever is smaller, and that costs about $7 million relative to base. Really what's happening is part of the shift savings are being allocated to spend in that fund. And then the final change is on line 17, federal stabilization funds. $275,600,000 is being subtracted from general ed, and that you'll down at the very bottom of the spreadsheet when we get into the federal funds area, there's an appropriation of $275,600 to restore those funds. And so the net change in general education on line 29 is about $1.8 billion. And then again, as you go down that column, that fifth column, all the other negatives relate to changing the payment shift to 7327. There are no other decision change items in the appropriation spreadsheet. So everything else you can see through the different lines are all base funding for all of the K-12 programs in your jurisdiction. So if you get down to page 3, line 191, you see all of the changes from the shifts and the federal savings amount to a reduction of $2,022,000,000 in state appropriations for fiscal year 2010 and 11. And then the totals of the shifts are summarized on line 247 for the property tax shift, and then at the top of page 4, line 253, the total for all aid payment shifts, including general ed, that I highlighted at the top. So there's about $1.8 billion of additional property tax and payment shift savings. So if you look at that, the number on line 191 on the sixth column from the right, total spending for fiscal year 10 and 11 in the House bill is $11,631,154,000. Then if you go down to line 260, you see that on the top of page 4, you see that your committee's general fund target was $11,631,154,000, so there's nothing remaining, which is what that line under that with the zero is. So all of your, you have hit, this bill hits that target you were given in the resolution exactly. That concludes the general fund. Then line 263 to 273 outlines federal funds. There's $275,600,000 in federal funds appropriated in the House bill. You can see that's slightly lower than the governor's total of $424 million. And so if you look on line 271, you kind of see the net effect of all of the changes backing out shifts and federal funds. And you can see compared to base, this House recommended bill would be $7 million higher than base, and that is just the loan fund for those districts in statutory operating debt. So basically, exempting that loan fund and including and backing out the effects of the shift and including the federal funds, the budget for K-12 education is the same for fiscal year 10 and 11 as it is under base. And then lines 278 through 284 are a special revenue fund. We have under current law, there is an appropriation for licensure by portfolio by the Board of Teaching. They have notified the legislature that they're collecting more fees because they're doing more licensure. So we have a base appropriation of $17,000, but that appropriation is reflected, is increased to $30,000 to reflect all of the additional fees that they're projected to collect because of the licensure by portfolio. And then on line 287, you see a note related to Article 9 and the cost of implementing that beginning in the 2014-15 biennium. Then your other spreadsheet, the education finance levy spreadsheet, is even simpler. If you look, the each of the columns to the left of a bold line is house minus current law or house minus base, and you see that every number in those columns is a zero. There are no changes to levies in this bill. There are some things that are tax related, but the net impact on levies is zero, and you see that all the way down. If you look at line 170 and 177, you see that house minus current law is zero. The governor had recommended about $10.5 million increase those levies in fiscal 2011, and slightly more in 12 and 13, all related to QCOM for the most part. But there are no changes in the House bill related to levy.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Crow. So you can see that the education funding is level, and there's quite a few shifts in here, as the governor did as well, which I don't think any of us are happy about. Representative Garofalo had the unhappy job of, you know, defending the governorship, and now here we have them in the House Democrat plan as well. We have tried, as members here know, when we go through the policy provisions, to have no new mandates and significantly reduced mandates, and that's something we're trying to do to tide schools over, and hopefully as we go through marking up the bill tomorrow, we'll remember that message and try to stick with it. So, any questions for Mr. Crow before we go to Mr. Representative Garofalo?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Crow, the finance sheet that I was working off of yesterday was the April 13th one as opposed to the April 14th one. And on row 271 under the governor's recommendation, it looks like there's been a change of about $40 million. I'm wondering if you can just account for me where, unfortunately, I was working up. Working out the old spreadsheet. Can you tell me where that $40 million came from?
Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, Representative Garofalo, line 267, federal stabilization, the $28 million was added. There was an additional amount above the offset that spreadsheet you had is looking at. And also, the governor used a portion of federal funds to offset a 2012 reduction in. Because of the 90-10, there was some 2012 impact of some of the reductions the governor was making, and those have been fully accounted for now on line 268.
Thank you.
All right. Mr. Crow, or Mr. Strom and Ms. Larson, I'm not sure. Mr. Strom, sorry.
Madam Chair, members, thank you. Ms. Larson and I will be working off the bill summary that's in your packet. We've been asked to be brief today, and what we'd like to do is basically summarize the articles for you and not spend time on those provisions that the committee has heard previously, just rather to identify those for you. So what I'd like to do is start with Article 1, and the first two sections are both from the MDE policy bill, House File 1179. Sections 3 and 4 of that summary were from Representative Emmer's bill, House File 107. The next seven sections were from the department's policy bill as well. Section 11 was Representative Nornes's bill, House File 320. Then sections 13 and 16 were Representative Marquardt's other post-employment benefits bill. That was House File 2224. And there's one change from how that bill was heard at the time it was presented to this committee, and that's the effective date. As members recall, the provisions in that bill require that for future OPEB bond sales that the voter approval must be obtained first. The effective day was pushed to August 1st, 2009. So that's a change from what this committee has previously seen. Then Section 14 was part of the package of changes that Representative Tilbury brought as his mandate reduction bill. And remains unchanged from when that came to this committee. Finally, then, the new language in the bill that this committee has not seen before are in sections 17 and 19 having to do with the general education offset from the federal funds. As Mr. Crow stated, the House has divided that money between higher education and K-12, and he's told you how the House is accounting for that money, and you can see from the spreadsheet how the $275 million of federal funds are being applied. Essentially, what's happening with that money is it's offsetting general education aid. So school districts will receive a reduction in general education aid, but that reduction will be made whole with the federal stimulus money. So essentially, the money from the stabilization account will not be new money for school districts. It will simply replace existing state aid, and there won't be any adjustments to the base revenue amounts that school districts were expecting. So the school districts should be expecting the exact same amount of general education revenue. It's just a portion of it now will be paid for with federal stimulus funds, and to the extent that those funds are essentially appropriated like all others, the school districts really won't notice that the stabilization money is a part of the payments that they're receiving. Their funding in general ed will be no higher or no lower than it otherwise would have been. So in summary, Madam Chair, that's what's in Article 1. Would you like us to take questions as we go through each article?
If anybody has any questions, they'll be on the list. They're not, so you can press on.
Okay, Madam Chair, Ms. Larson will address Article 2.
Madam Chair, members, in the interest of complying with the Chair's request to be brief, Article 2 is the single largest section single largest article in this bill, and I will try to be very brief. All of the provisions that are in here were heard either by the Education Policy Committee, the K-12 Education Finance Committee, or both, and they represent an amalgam of various bills presented before one or the other or both of those committees. On page 18, section 1 of the bill, you see the shared services provisions from Representative Swale and McFarland. Following that are several MDE provisions. Sprinkled throughout, beginning on section 4 in Article 2, are a number of mandate reduction proposals that were included in Representative Tilbury's bill. Section 5 was an MDE provision. Section 6 came from Representative Tilbury's mandate reduction bill. Sections 7 and 8 were proposed by Representative Dabney, having to do with concurrent enrollment.
And I guess I would say, if there's anybody here that's interested in the concurrent enrollment, while we are holding schools harmless in this bill, we did end up with this bill, which does affect the funding for APIB. And the reason that we even got into this topic when we're trying to hold schools harmless is because the governor cut the funding for college and the schools. And so this was, since we had no money to put that money back, having the Dabney bill was our only way to deal with that for now. Okay, go ahead.
Madam Chair, members, sections 9 through 13 are amalgam of a bill that Representative Reinert authored having to do with statewide accountability. Those sections also include provisions authored by Representative Kalin having to do with computer adaptive testing, Representative Mariani having to do both with temporary alternative to the reading and math grad test, as well as additional information provided and analysis provided to the legislature. On page 44 and following, you'll see one of several provisions from part of a bill that Representative Swales introduced on homes, alleviating mandates on homeschool families. Sections 15 and 16 were proposed by the department. Section 17 and a number of sections that follow came from a bill from Representative Taft having to do with best teaching practices. Section 18 is an alternative teacher preparation program proposed by Representative Mariani. Sections 19 through 26 are again from the bill that Representative Taft authored. On page 53, sections 27 to 29 were proposed by the department. On section 56, you see a bill proposed by Representative Detmer offering to allow districts to pay for volunteer background checks. On page 58, section 31, that's a bill from Representative Bigham clarifying the intent with respect to reporting misconduct of teachers when boards are preparing to hire. Section 32 is a bill authored by Representative Benson on self-governed schools. Section 33 came from the department. Section 34 is also from the department. Sections 37 through 39 are provisions on online learning authored by Representative Dietrich. On page 40 and all the way, I'm sorry, section 40 on page 68, sections 40, 41, and 42 are amendments to the charter school law proposed by Representative Slocum. And then on to page 91, you'll see sections 43 through 49 were all proposed by the department. On page 94, sections 48 and 49 were department proposals. Sections 50 through 52 came from Representative Newton's bill on integration revenue. On page 96, section 53 through 55 were proposals from the department. On page 100, section 56, the 220 partnership was a bill of Representative Swales. On page 101, sections 57 through 60 are again part of or some of the sections in a bill that Representative Swales authored, alleviating homeschool families from certain mandates. Section 61 on page 104, and then section 62 also is again from Representative Reinert's bill. It establishes processes for determining the forms that the educational accountability indicators will take. On page 106, section 63 is from a bill that Representative Mariani authored, having to do with temporary alternatives to the high-stakes math and reading test. On page 107, section 64 is part, again, of Representative Newton's bill. Section 65 on the Labor Day start date came from Representative Norton. Section 66 is the appropriation section, and section 67 contains the repealers that are spelled out for you on page 23 of your bill summary. Also, in the interest of going quickly through this, Article 3 is an amalgam of several bills.
And Ms. Larson, before you go to Article 3, there aren't any questions on Article 2 yet. But members, if you do have questions, feel free to ask them. I wanted the presentation to be shorter because we all know this bill. But if there are questions, though, this is a chance for members to ask them. And we do want to hear from the public. We did check and see if we could have this room longer or if we could go longer so that we didn't have to go through so fast. But unfortunately, several of us are on the Early Childhood Committee that does meet right after our committee time, and there we are voting and marking up the bill, so we could not go later. But we only have seven people signed up. There may be more, but we do have time for questions, so I don't want to imply that members can't ask questions if you have them. This is not the time for pontificating, but it is the time for questions. Representative Ward, and that was no reflection on what you might say.
Well, Madam Chair, thank you, and mine is about pontificating, too. I want to still talk about Labor Day start. A number of my public still are contacting me about the pre-Labor Day start and as problematic. So I want to represent my folks down here that who are not able to be here today on that. And I just want to make that comment.
Very good. Thank you, Representative Ward. And then Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And actually, a question for you is that my understanding was that provision was actually defeated in a committee above us. It was defeated in the Finance Committee. And I thought that when you defeated a bill, that meant that it was defeated.
Representative Grapple, you've been here long enough to know that anything can pop up anywhere, and we don't pay any attention to other committees. This is the K-12 Finance Committee, and here it is, and you can defeat it again tomorrow if you wish.
Madam Chair.
Representative Grapple, are you finished?
Oh, I've always been, Madam Chair, I've always been wanting to respect the committee process.
Very good. So okay. Representative Stillberry.
Madam Chair, I just wanted to remind others that we had that bill added on to the mandate reduction bill. That's where it came from, or why it came back into effect. Representative Benson offered that as an amendment.
Thank you, Representative Tilbury. That's a much better answer than I gave. I hope that Representative Garofalo took great note of that. There was process here. Thank you, Representative Tilbury, Representative Benson, for that process. Okay, Article 3, Ms. Larson.
Madam Chair, members, in the interest of going quickly, Article 3 is really an amalgam of a number of bills that are reflected in these sections through 22. They include House File 1701 that Representative Newton worked on. It was a work in progress, and there was considerable effort by special education stakeholders in reaching an agreement on various sections of special education law. They are reflected in here. Also, there was a bill from Representative Dabney, House File 621, having to do with restrictive procedures. This, too, was a result of efforts of many stakeholders coming together and reaching agreement on the language that's reflected in here. There is language from Representative Mariani's bill, House File 1667, having to do with care and treatment provisions. There is MDE language having to do with state interagency council expiration date. There is a proposal from the Deaf and Hard of Hearing Council, and also appropriations and repealers, as you can see at the back of Article 3.
Okay. Article 4.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Article 4 is the Facilities and Equipment Article and Technology. Starts on page 141 of the bill, and on page 29 of the bill summary. Section 1 on the wind energy conversion system is the language from the amendment to Representative Bly's bill. This gives the authority to school boards to enter into agreements to run windmills solely for that purpose, as long as they don't engage in the business of being a utility and selling or selling that electricity at retail. Sections 2 to 5 in this bill are new language to the committee, but are the same as the concept that was presented in part of Representative Tilbury's bill. These changes have to do with the recommendations regarding the mandate reductions for facilities purposes, and change the review and comment process a bit, and also the notification process for certain bond issues. This was the goal of those provisions all along, but this language is different than the form that you last saw this language in. Madam Chair, Section 6 of the bill is part of two things. It contains some language from the department. It contains the language from Representative Hornstein's bill regarding the minimum acreage sites, and that the department cannot deny a school site simply based on the acreage. This was a part of the discussion that we had with 1179, but this is from Representative Hornstein, this section 6 and section 8. Section 7 was also part of Representative Tilbury's bill regarding the review and comments. Again, this is new language to the committee. The department pointed out to us that there would be some cost to the state if those school districts that received capital loans were exempt from the $500,000 limit, that there would be more one-day bond sales, essentially. So the language here raises the requirement for a review and comment. A school district's not required to receive one if the value of the property is the project is $1.4 million or higher, except for those districts that have capital loans, and they're still subject to the $500,000 limit. Then on lines 145, page 145, lines 10 and 11, this language is also part of the mandate reduction language and would essentially exempt certain projects that already have reviews from an additional review for purposes of those bond sales. As I mentioned, Section 8 is language you've seen before as part of Representative Hornstein's amendment to 1179. Section 9 is new language from Representative Tilbury's bill regarding the publication of certain alternative facilities projects. Then, Madam Chair, Sections Section 10 is from the governor's bill from House File 1172 that we've seen before, and the appropriations then follow in Section 11, and I believe Mr. Crowe has explained those appropriations to the committee.
Very good. We have one question on Article 4, Representative Demmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question relates to in Article 4, Section 1, the wind energy conversion system. I don't recall, prohibits the schools from selling, transmitting, and distributing energy at retail. Does that mean that if they put a tower up, they'd have to use the power from that tower directly right there? I don't recall how that works.
Mr. Strachan.
Madam Chair, I am not as familiar with this as I should be. When the bill was presented to the committee, Representative Bly stated that this definition essentially would keep them from performing as a utility. It's not my understanding that this would in other ways limit the school district's ability to transfer that power to, you know, from a remote site to the school. I think it has to do with the retail sale, so that the school district, I believe, would not be able to sell that power to others in the community as a utility. That was the purpose of the amendment that was offered, but I'm afraid I'll check with our utility analyst and get back to you, but I can't give you a better answer than that currently.
Representative Demmer.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I'm sorry. I wish I would have. Maybe I didn't make the connection when we listened to this, or maybe I missed the conversation. I don't know if the technology exists to be able to hook up directly and run your school on a windmill. Generally speaking, when you put up the windmill, you sell the power off to the grid, and then the income offsets what you're paying for power from the grid, and it's kind of an in and out. And I wonder if this would be, unless I'm interpreting this wrong, it could be problematic.
Madam Chair, Representative Demmer, this has to do with the retail sale, not the wholesale sale. So if they're selling it to the grid, and my understanding is that's a wholesale sale, so that would not impact that, but it would keep these districts from forming essentially their own utility and then offering to sell that utility the power from that utility to others.
All right. Then Article 5. Library, new system, and accounting.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Article 5 starts on page 150 of the bill. This article has to do with libraries, which are not an account in this bill yet, nutrition and accounting, and has the shift provisions in them. Let me briefly describe these provisions for you. Section 1 was from Representative Tilbury's bill on the mandate reductions, reducing the amount of information that needed to be published regarding certain board publications regarding their budget. Section 2 of the bill was a provision from the department bill from House File 1179. This committee has seen that before. Section 3 of the bill, the levy recognition shift, is similar to that the governor presented. However, the shift level is slightly different. If you look in the language of the bill on page 152, line 30, you'll see that the shift percentage that the House K-12 committee is using is 49.1%. The governor's levy shift number was 48.6%. So the slightly different line item, but the language is otherwise the same. The next couple of sections, Section 4 was from Representative Tilbury and had to do with the expenditures on the building level. That language the committee has seen before. Sections 5 to 7 were from the governor's bill. Section 8 is a result of Representative Rukavina's bill, but is new language to this committee. If you'll look on page 156, starting at the top of that page, the circumstance here involved food service accounts, and the bill that Representative Rukavina brought would have exempted private providers of food service contract companies, management companies, from being required to eliminate a deficit that occurred in the food service fund under their contract period. This language is a language that was worked on with the department and others. And what the language does is extends the period of time for which the deficit can run and also allows certain circumstances to be taken into effect when the deficit is determined. I'm not sure that all parties are 100% in agreement with this language. The concept was discussed at a committee hearing earlier, but this is the first, I think, members have seen this particular language. The next several sections of the bill, sections 9 through 14, have to do with the shift percentages. Again, the language here is roughly the same with some slight modifications on the amount. The House shift percentage on line 157.24 on page 157, line 24, the House shift percentage would go to 73%. Compared to the current law number of 90% or the governor's recommendation of 80%. And additionally, that change, I believe, is the only difference in the language from the governor's. Madam Chair, then on page 160 of the bill, two provisions, 15 and 16, work from House File 1179, the governor's recommendation. The next three sections were part of Representative Tilbury's bill that picked up the original language from Representative Lanning regarding the truth and taxation process. And there may need to be some coordination as we go forward with the Tax Committee on the truth and taxation provision. Finally, Madam Chair, in Section 19, the Tilbury bill recommended extending the one-time capital account transfers from last year for two more years, so districts would be allowed to transfer an additional $51 per pupil per year in both June 30th, 2009 and 2010 from the reserve account to their undesignated general fund balance. Section 20 was Representative Lane's fund transfer bill in the form that was brought to this committee. And then the appropriations follow in Section 21, as were explained on the fiscal spreadsheet. Section 22 is the repealer of some of the truth and taxation provisions that accompanied the provision of Representative Tilbury.
Mr. Anderson.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Just a clarification again back to Section 8. The private contracting firm would be liable for that deficit if there was one in the food service account under this language?
Mr. Strong.
Madam Chair, Representative Anderson, under the existing law, the food service company needed to make a payment directly to the school district to eliminate the deficit. And now, as the language at the top of page 156 shows, that there's a calculation of what can be excluded from that deficit, so that if there's a contractually agreed upon difference in the price of the meals, the a la carte, the vending, and the catering expenses, that those can be factored into that. So both parties would have to agree to that in order to determine that deficit. Whatever deficit remaining after that would be attributable to the food service company, and then the food service company essentially gets a second year in which to make up that deficit, so it doesn't have to be paid after the end of the first year. So it both expands the definition of the deficit to allow some modifications to that and adds a second year.
And Representative Anderson, these are the changes that the department agreed to. So Representative Covina would be the one that Mr. Strom was referring to, who wouldn't be totally happy with these changes. He wanted more, but we went with the ones the department approved. Any other questions on this section? Okay, Article 6.
Madam Chair, members, Articles 6 and 7 are both very brief and come largely from department proposals. Article 6 at this time simply reflects an interest in repealing school and community advisory teams. So there's a section of statute that referenced those teams is being amended to strike the reference, and then there is a repealer consistent with that intent. In Article 7, the language governing state agencies pertains to grants and gifts. This is largely from the department. However, there is language on page 170, beginning on line 26, that requires the commissioner to report to the legislature about the gifts and grants that the department received and the purposes for which they were granted. Then you'll see there is an appropriation section, or several appropriation sections that follow.
Any questions on 6 or 7? Justin Krasnoff.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess I was just wondering, and maybe a question for the Chair, is that I was surprised to see that the agency operating reduction is not in there. That I know most agencies are tightening their belts right now, and this would have been an opportunity to fund some of the Chair's programs that she supported. And if you could perhaps enlighten the members of the committee as to why we're protecting the agency and not funding in the classroom. Any guidance on that for us?
Representative Broccolo, we decided that as long as we have level funding for education and we weren't making any increases, we weren't making any cuts, that we would just not make those reductions in this bill. We are giving the department a lot more assignments to do. If we end up, however, having the tax bill vetoed, which of course is what holds up this bill, being able to do this, then when we do have to make cuts, if should that happen, and we could not secure that funding with on a bipartisan basis, then there will be a lot more cuts made in a lot more areas, and I suspect the agency at that point will not remain intact. Representative Broccolo.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I now understand why.
All right. Article 8.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, Article 8 is the transportation, the pupil transportation article of the bill, and starts on page 172 of the bill. These provisions are all from Representative Swales' bill, House File 1856, with one exception. And that is on page 183, section 13, is the type 3 bill that Representative Ward offered that has passed out of this committee separately. But House File 116, the content of that in its current form is the same as section 13 of this bill. Otherwise, Article 8 is entirely as is as presented by Representative Swales to the committee.
Okay, Article 9.
Madam Chair, members, Article 9 is the original House File 2 with just a couple of changes. Let me highlight those changes for you. First, the effective dates have been pushed back so that the new school finance system would become effective beginning in fiscal year 2014. So all throughout the article, the effective dates have been moved back to 2014. Second, the location equity index, which is on page 191 of the bill in section 10, has been modified. There was some discussion about that provision. Previous to the change, it was based on both the average weekly wage level and aggregate housing values in each county. The index has been recalculated based simply on the wage level, on the average weekly wage level for each county. And essentially the cut points have been changed a little bit as well. The index would rely on 50% of the school district's wage level from the county where it's located and 50% of the economic development region's wage level where the county is located. It's the average of those two that forms the index. A school district that is at least 90% of the state average in wage index would be eligible for funding under it, and the maximum increase for a district would be a 15% increase. As you look later in the bill, you'll see that the formula for it is one-half of the formula allowance, so essentially a district receiving the maximum amount of the location equity index adjustment would be receiving a 7.5% increase in its overall level of basic funding. Next, Madam Chair, there was a great deal of discussion in Representative Mariani's committee regarding the innovation revenue, and that language begins on page 203 of the bill in section 32. This is language that is also new to the committee. The form of this, a different form of this, was in the original bill, and a different form from that was in Representative Mariani's bill. And this goes through and identifies the process and procedure for school districts to use when dealing with the innovation revenue. In terms of differences from the language from Representative Mariani's committee, this language would apply only to, in terms of the approval process from the department, would apply only if a school district is not meeting the targets established, the academic performance targets established for it. And finally, Madam Chair, the phase-in of the new school finance system is put forth in Section 41, which starts on page 209, and essentially a four-year phase-in schedule is anticipated, with the first year being 2014, fiscal year 2014, phased in over 4 years at 25% per year, so that in the first year we're estimating about a $600 million impact, in the second year about a $1.2 billion impact, et cetera. So that, Madam Chair, are the only differences to the original language of House File 2.
And thank you, Mr. Chair, and herein lies the optimism of the bill. We think and believe and know that we are going to get out of this economic slump. We are going to write our budget and come up with enough money to have a balanced budget. And when we get done with the stimulus money, even by the time we get to 2014, and hopefully sooner, but because we passed the amendment on the floor that we have to balance the budget for 4 years, this is as early as we could put this in here given our economic circumstances. But should things turn around with the federal stimulus and things that we do here in our state by investing in and protecting education, then we might be able to start it sooner. If not, at least it's in here so that we are on an equal footing with other budgets in our state budget, some of which get forecasted in a way so that even if they take a cut, it's only a cut in their anticipated increase, and they still get an overall increase. This way, education will be treated that way as well, and it gives us hope to get out of this economic circumstance when so many of the bills that so many people around this table have put forward over the last 3 years can finally be enacted, and they are in here. And it gives me the most hope, despite the fact that I hate shifts. I never thought I would provide over a flat funding education bill, but I'm thankful it's not a cut. But still, to have this in here is hope for the future, and hopefully we can all in this room, all of us in this room, work on that and fight for it as we go forward through the years. Representative Brown.
I just didn't hear. Mr. Frum, did you, thank you, Madam Chair, did you state a number of years for the phase-in? I saw unspecified, and I thought I heard you say a number of years.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative Brown, over 4 years, starting in fiscal year 2014.
Mm-hmm. And it's 4 years. Originally, we were looking at 6 years, but because we have to delay starting, we still wanted to end at the same point. And, of course, if economic circumstances change, everything can always be changed by a future legislature. But we're looking optimistically at keeping our place even when we have this huge deficit, two-thirds of which is beyond our control, one-third of which we created when we made some decisions. Those of us were here long enough to have made those decisions, and our budget has been out of balance ever since. Any other questions on Article 9, or actually any questions on the entire bill? Before we go to testimony, Mr. Strump. Oh, we have two more articles.
If I could just add
very
briefly.
I was thinking the House File 2, Section Article 9 was the be-all and end-all, but there's more. Okay.
Madam Chair, barely worth mentioning. Article 10 is the forecast adjustments article. This is a common procedure for the legislature to make up for last year's shortfalls or adjust last year's appropriations down if they're over the entitlement amount. There may be some discussion about a few of these appropriations that are lower than current law given the treatment in a past year. And then Article 11 is a technical corrections article, of which we only have one. These are items that are brought to us by the revisor's office where they find errors in the statute or obsolete language in the statute.
Thank you very much, Mr. Strom. And now we go back to any questions from members before we go to testimony from the audience. We'll go to testimony then from the audience, and we have seven people signed up, so I'm going to take those seven people first, and then anyone else who is in the audience as we have time. So the first two, if two people, actually there's three chairs up there, I'll read off three names so that we don't have to waste time waiting for people to come down. So we have Paula Leach, Debbie Hattis, and Linnea Bradshaw. Welcome to the committee, and if Paula Leach could go first, and of course say your name and then say who you're representing, if anyone, and then give us your testimony.
Okay. Good afternoon, Madam Chair. Good afternoon, committee members. Again, my name is Paula Leach, and I am an early childhood special education teacher from the Hastings District. And I am here today to talk with you a little bit about why I am not for the alternative teacher preparation proposal. And first of all, I'll just give you a little background on early childhood special education. It is a shortage area. We serve children birth through age 7, and we are the first people that families meet when they're being introduced to the K-12 special ed system. We go into homes. We are in preschool settings. We are in community education settings. So a lot of what we do has a medical background to it. We also work in collaboration with other agencies. There is that business model there. Some of the things that we do right off the bat is a comprehensive evaluation. So we look at cognition and communication, motor skills, height, weight, vision, hearing. We look at how the parents are bonding with the child, if the child's in foster care. We look at, oh, is this child prenatally exposed to drugs? Was this child a victim of child abuse? We're looking at the entire picture there, and there are a lot of unique circumstances we need to consider. If we think a child does need early intervention, but the tests say otherwise, we are able to use informed clinical opinion. But again, I believe that someone that's been through a high degree of training would be able to make that. When I first moved to Minnesota in 2004, I was here at the very beginning of a lot of changes to the Minnesota Early Intervention System. Back in 2004, Minnesota was ranked 50th out of all 50 states for birth-to-one child fine practices. And over the past few years, we've been playing catch-up just to make sure that we are where the federal government would like us to be. And though we are doing an excellent job at really playing catch-up, the thought of taking someone who only has about 5 weeks of training, even though they're being mentored, and throwing them into a system where we're working immediately with families, immediately with little ones in need, and saying, okay, you have to catch up with the rest of us, and you have 5 weeks to do it, is a little overwhelming to me. 3 to 5 teachers also need to understand characteristics of not just development, but what a developmental delay looks like in difference with atypical development. Sometimes we are called in to do an evaluation, and it's by a parent that says, I think that my 3-year-old isn't talking. I think we might need speech therapy. And when we come in the door and we go to evaluate the 3-year-old, we can tell right away, I think we're looking at autism. Someone that is formally trained will have the ability to not only provide that comprehensive evaluation, but that sensitivity to know they have to deliver a very devastating message. And where do you help the family pick up the pieces and move on to do the best they can for their child? Again, as I mentioned a little while ago, I did move up here in 2004 from Missouri. And back when I was teaching in Missouri, I had some paraprofessionals be in my classroom. And I bring this up because as I'm listening to the proposal, it reminds me a lot of the Teach for America program, which I think is a wonderful program. I think, though, about my 2 paraprofessionals that came in, and they were there about a half a day. Some of them were there about, 2 days a week, some 3 days a week. But the 2 that went on to graduate with degrees in business and moved on into Teach for America had been under my wing, and they had watched me as a teacher. I'd been a teacher for 8 years at that point, struggle, because I had very challenging students and challenging family issues. And so I was kind of a mentor for them. They moved on. They both ended up in Baltimore. And I had a crying phone call from each one of them at some point during the year. I don't know what to do. This is so hard. My administrator won't listen to me. They were both gone after a year. And I think that definitely one of them would have been an amazing teacher. But unlike me, when I've struggled in my career, I had a firm foundation to fall back on and to hold me together when I had a challenging year. And I think about those 2 girls, and they had training, they had watched another teacher work, but they didn't have all of those years of experience to say, I'm going to get through this year, and maybe I'll try some different techniques, and maybe I'll call someone that was at my college to pick their brain for other ideas. And Madam Chair and committee members, I just want to have you think about other ideas that you could use. I appreciate creativity because in early childhood we do a lot of creative thinking. And I think about looking at teachers that have maybe left the field and left their licenses expire. because they chose to take some time off to have children? What about inviting them back into the field to join some of our harder to fill areas? I wonder about families that are relocating to Minnesota with all of the hoops to jump through in order to get a Minnesota teaching license. What about asking teachers that are from other states to come here? And if they're in good standing in their other state, why not let them have a position here? Because, again, they do have that background. I want to thank you for your time and your consideration.
Thank you very much. Debbie Haddis. Okay, sorry.
Madam Chair, Committee, my name is Debbie Haddis. I teach ELL at Apple Valley High School. I've been there since 1987, and I'm also speaking against the alternative licensing bill. I have several points I'd like to make. The first two are specifically about my field. When I started teaching ELL in the late 1970s, we were basically serving the Southeast Asian refugees. Now the population is so much more diverse with dozens and dozens of languages. But more than that, more than the language diversity, we have students, we call them Generation 1.5. They were born in this country or they've been in ELL almost their entire lives. We have students who come here highly prepared, doing grade level work in their native language. We have people who come here and they've never been in a school before. And all of these kids are in our classrooms. It's a very diverse population. We also, in order to teach these people, I went to school with a year of classwork to get my license in the field. And this is way different than what you can do in a five-week class. I took classes in linguistics and in grammar to see how the English language is put together. I took classes in language acquisition to see how people learn the language. How you learn it as a child is similar to but not the same as how you learn it when a different language when you're older and have more cognitive abilities. I took classes on methodology. When I studied French in high school, I repeated after my teacher, and that was the methodology. We've come a long way in learning how to teach a language. I took various classes in the sociolinguistics, anthro-linguistics. How do we use language? What purpose? Do we speak the same way to Madam Chair that we do to tell our 17-year-old to wash the dishes? I don't think so. I hope not. Which brings me...
Yeah, are you listening?
Excuse me. Is there something personal?
Yeah.
Well, how do you make the transition to do that? And that's in student teaching. It's the transition to the real-world classroom, from the classes that you take when you do your practice teaching to a bunch of other graduate students. It's not quite the same to a bunch of 25 or 35 real-world kids. But the intensive supervision that's allowed in student teaching really is invaluable. It gives you a safe place to try those new ideas. You get frequent feedback. In the mentoring, your mentor is teaching his or her own full-time job. He doesn't have a chance to visit with you every day. And a lot of student teachers, it's a safe place to say, you know what, I guess I'm not so sure about that career. And one of the big places that student teaching hits the reality is in classroom management. And I'm just going to give you a tiny story that's not to make me look good. When I was student teaching, I got in a little bit of a heated confrontation with a student, and I don't think I was hearing her, and she wasn't hearing me. And the next day, my supervisor, next day, not weeks, months, years later, she said, you know, I think there might be other ways to get your point across and get kids to want to do what they need to do. And that was a big gift to me, because if I hadn't had somebody tell me the next day that I'd kind of made a boo-boo, I would have probably thought, I did that right. That child was way out of line. And I would have started my teaching career in a way that probably wouldn't have been as productive, and it might have dead-ended. And over the years, I've had the privilege of passing on this gift of her attention to a dozen or so student teachers. And it's a really thrilling experience watching a teacher in a safe environment learn. It eases their transition to this rewarding profession. The alternative licensing program, I see it as a sink or swim. You know, there probably are a few wonderful teachers out there who are just, with that chance, can do it. But these waters are sometimes a little bit, should I say, shark infested, and it's tough. We're going to lose some people who probably, as Paula said, have some great potential. But more than that, you know who the real losers are. It's our kids who are sitting in a classroom with a teacher who's floundering, and I don't want to see that. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Linnea Bradshaw.
My name is Linnea Bradshaw, and I've been teaching Japanese in District 196 for the past 18 years. I earned my teaching license in the post-baccalaureate program for teachers of second language and cultures at the University of Minnesota. And through the years, I've worked with 6 native speaker assistants and 5 student teachers, 2 of whom were also native speakers. I am here to testify against the bill on the alternative teacher preparation. To an outsider, my teaching area, world languages, might seem to be a good match for this bill. Indeed, it even may have been an impetus for it. There are many native speakers and also trained foreign language speakers in our communities who cannot teach in public schools simply for a lack of license and who want in. However, there's a huge difference between knowing something and knowing how to teach it. I think Debbie really touched on that. Most native speakers, even one with college degrees, including all of the assistants I've worked with, do not have sufficient knowledge of the linguistics and deep structure of their language to be able to explain it. And without that linguistic training, it's impossible to make good decisions about how to teach, what to teach, and in what order to teach it. It's not enough to follow a book or a district curriculum guide. I liken it to a dentist who's fixing your teeth. Do you want him to have to follow the diagrams in his text while he's doing it, or do you want him to know what he's doing before you sit down?
Or her.
I am so sorry. Thank you very much. And her. You should want the same for those who teach your children. And the act of teaching itself is not easy. Again, Debbie touched on how hard it is to actually learn the art of finessing the curriculum so that the students can really understand it. Even the best lesson plans fail if not delivered properly. And even people who want to teach or think they can are not necessarily going to be able to do it. And that's what student teaching is for, is to develop those skills. While our current system may not be the best or perfectly ideal, the procedure that this bill outlines would allow completely unqualified people to teach our children. And they would be teaching them for real, not for practice, not in a highly supervised student teaching setting. New teachers cannot learn what they need to know about kids, about teaching, about the subject matter in 200 hours. And then after that, when they're faced with the classroom, they have nothing to fall back on. So have a mentor, but will it be a nearby, highly qualified mentor in their subject area? When I supervise student teachers, I've been present in the classroom, redirecting, giving feedback on a daily basis. New teachers to the classroom need this level of mentorship. They will not get it under this bill. I would submit to you that they will get virtually no meaningful mentorship at all, and I can guarantee it. If someone is licensed to teach world language in outstate Minnesota through this process. I'll close with an example of what happened in a district in Minnesota. Japanese was very popular back in the late 1980s, early 1990s. A lot of programs sprung up. There was a teacher who was hired on a variance without a license, fluent speaker of Japanese. he was there for 2 years at the school. He was now rehired for his 3rd year. The new teacher who took over found out that not only did she need to do the beginning curriculum with her first-year students, she needed to do it with her second-year students and her third-year students. And those students who were juniors and had taken 2 years of Japanese had nothing to show for it. And I think that is absolutely a shame, and that is something that has to be avoided. Rather than this, I do believe that we should be putting our efforts toward mentoring new teachers who have gone through the process. Teaching is hard enough for those who are new to the classroom, even after their student teaching and their education. We should not be looking toward this, so thank you very much.
Thank you all very much. The next three are Dan Alsweiger, Peter Noel, and Julia Kotke. Who is that? Oh, and one other person. I guess we can wait on the two then for AP and IB since there's two of them. But Dan Alsweiger and Peter Noel.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, and all Charter Education Minnesota, and I don't think I need to say anything more other than what these highly qualified licensed teachers had to say. They went through the regular process. As our members have been very energized, I will say, as I know you know already, by this issue, because they take their profession so seriously, and they want high-quality licensed teachers who have been well-prepared teaching right next to them. And I would just end by saying that we have a number of things that we could do to close the achievement gap and to deal with any shortage we have. And I know that Representative Mariani has great goals in mind in trying to put this provision forward, but we think that some of the efforts could focus on induction for new teachers, focusing on mentoring so that we can attract teachers and we can retain them. We lose teachers just like in the Teach for America program because they don't have the support that they need. A few years ago, there were loan forgiveness bills, and I know money is tight, but we could be recruiting individuals, people of color, so that we have more diversity in the teaching force. We could recruit people for a number of reasons, whatever the needs are, through loan forgiveness. Even the governor's provision you teach is something that could be considered, where he focuses on math and science in the colleges and then tries to get them into the teaching profession. Even salaries, where we could attract high-quality people into teaching because we have a decent salary and benefit structure. So rather than going this route, we would suggest other alternatives. We would be more than happy to work with anyone in the legislature to try to maintain high-quality licensed teachers in the state of Minnesota. And if there are any needs, we're ready there to work right along the side with you.
Thank you very much. And we are, I'm sure, going to be discussing this more tomorrow. And when we mark up the bill tomorrow, then we do not have to be out of our room. Shannon Patrick and Liz Mandelman have made sure that we have our room as long as we want it, even if it's 5 a.m. tomorrow. But today is the day we're cut for time, so we can't discuss it anymore. But I do know that this will be discussed more tomorrow, and Representative Mariani also has an amendment that he will be bringing forward as well as part of that discussion. Mr. Dole.
Madam Chair, members, thank you for the opportunity to speak on this important measure. My name is Pete Knoll. I'm Education Director of Minnesota Catholic Conference, and I bring before you an issue that we've expressed concern about in previous committee hearings, and that has to do with the repeal of non-public special education instruction and transportation. That would be on page 141, line 20 of the bill. And essentially, as we view it, that would dismantle special education services for non-public school students who are eligible under IDEA, parentally placed by their parents in a non-public school, so that they can avail themselves of the optimal setting for their education. Essentially, what it does, in effect, would be to roll back to federal funding, which, as you know, is about 14% roughly here in Minnesota, of the total amount that's presently allocated for this service. What the impact would be, and here's where, you know, one of our concerns lies, is in the unintended consequence of this. We feel that this would cause many parents to have to send their child to enroll their child in a public school and actually add to the state deficit, in effect, because in addition to the special education services program, it would require the allocation, local and state monies, for the general education too. So we have concerns about that you know, actually in a time when, as we all know, is fiscally strapped, that would add to the deficit. So for those reasons, we would ask you to please reconsider and rescind the repealer of 125A.18. I would stand for any questions that you may have.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. Then we have Julia Kotsky, and it says, and one other person. So here's the one other person. All right. And Julia can go first.
Juliana, yes. Thank you. I'm Juliana Kotsky, and I was the AP coordinator for 20 years in Minnetonka School, and now the current chair of the Minnesota Advanced Placement Advisory Council. Thank you for listening to me today. I know that you had a chance to hear some concerns that AP and IB can have over the folding in of the concurrent program into the factors it was designed for AP and IB. They are apples and oranges. I like apples and I like oranges, but they are two different entities completely. AP and IB are uniquely structured and have a unique support system. The curriculum is globally developed. The content of the trainings is again globally developed. The training is for IEP is a national training. There are external evaluations for every single one of those components. In addition, our teachers, which was to me one of the best professional growths, every year receive feedback specifically to their student performance. That data they would use to incorporate into their instructions for constant improvement. Enrollment. The concurrent enrollment also recognizes the value of accreditation, national accreditation. That's why it was indicated in their proposal and in prior proposals that after 2011, no school could have funding unless they had been accredited or met the standards of the National Association of NASA. And that program is currently under revision. It is going to be ready with its new accreditation process and new standards January of 2011. Would it be prudent to wait until 2011 when this process and their standards will be available to us to make a prudent decision over whether these programs should indeed be blended together into one statute? As it is now, they have already a statute, a home. They have a home in 124D.0191. If you want to fund those programs that are offered by the university or outstate institutions, do so in that statute. But please don't blend them together, at least without research and thought and new data. Secondly, the academic grants that are provided by 120B-122, please include AP and IB in this funding, as it has been in the past. The funding has dramatically changed from $6.5 down to $2 million. But we still deserve to be at the table. 22 schools, many in your district, received that money and have done fabulous things with it. The key criteria for the program, for the grants, was we need that scaffolding, we need that infrastructure at the middle school level to assure that all students have access and are ready for and can do well in a college and a high school setting. And even more important, do well in college, which is their ultimate goal. Those programs, to a vast majority, used the already developed pre-AP and IB curriculum, training, and vertical training program that's rich and wonderful and exists. Please don't deny access to teachers to this opportunity by zero funding for AP and IB. Jessica Vinolia, was a principal at Brooklyn Center Junior High and was a part of the grant process for this year and would love to share with you some of his insights.
Next day, I'm Giuseppe Mendelier, principal of Brooklyn Junior High School, which is a member of the Osseo Area Schools. I come to you as a principal of a school of 1,100 students, 67% diverse, 52% free and reduced lunch with 30% mobility. A huge challenge that was set in front of me. Also come to you as a parent today. My son is 18 and my youngest son is 10. My oldest son actually went through the NYP program, and that set him in very strong academic sense, gave him a lot of rigor in his education in the middle years. When he reached high school, he decided he wasn't enjoying high school. He decided to go to PSEO College, and currently he's at the U of M doing college classes as a senior. So I'm thankful for the NYP program that put him in that place, in that position in his academic career. And I'm very, very nervous right now, and I can't figure it out. I talked to 1,100 junior high kids all day long, but I think I just got the call an hour ago to be down here. So at Brooklyn Junior, when I arrived at Brooklyn Junior four years ago as principal, my sister school across the way became an IB school and a middle years program school. And I tried to think, what would I do differently to mark Brooklyn Junior as a school of excellence that parents choose to go to? I think it's a question of choice. As a parent, I chose to send my son to the NYP program at Sandberg Middle School. What choice do the Osseo area parents have if we take this funding away? I have 80% of my teachers trained in pre-AP programming, and for the past 3 years, I've gone from just the high-performance teachers being trained to the majority of the staff trained now, with the expectation that next year we're going to start an AP class in ninth grade. I've been battling with my personal district to say that this is an okay thing to bring into the curriculum, but it's going to be a pilot program. So next year we have 45 kids in ninth grade signed up for an AP college-level class. This will be the first one in ninth grade in the Osseo area school system. We're a large school system. That's very impactful. I'd like to tell you that the opportunities that the teachers have for training in the summertime is awesome. They go to that training, they get renewed, they come back with improved practice, new techniques to bring into the classroom. It's sometimes difficult being a principal. You think about behavior, think about AYP. You mustn't let go of what happens to the kids at the high end. What are we doing for our kids at the top? Losing this funding would mean that I would not be able to send teachers for training. I'd like you to reconsider that part. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And we have, in addition to the emails that Ms. Alfreger referred to, we've heard a lot on this one as well. So thank you very much. And again, I'm sure you were here at the beginning when I said the reason this came up at all is because of the governor cutting the concurrent enrollment college in the schools funding. So unfortunately, this is what we're working on because of that. Otherwise, I think it probably wouldn't have been touched, and we'll see as we go forward how this goes. So thank you.
I think we have to remember that we're a state of choice.
Thank you very much.
We're grateful for your time.
Thank you. Mr. Bartholomew, who's the last person on the list. Is there anyone, we can take others as time allows. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify? Okay. Mr. Bartholomew.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, members. First, I'd just like to ask with the Minnesota Business Partnership. First, I want to just thank you for the time and thought you and the committee have put into developing House File 2. Never an easy process and many, many long hours. And there are provisions in this bill that will benefit students directly. And a couple examples, Representative Flocum, of course, left, but the charter school initiatives that she's worked on, and Representative Benson, some of the things he's done with creating alternative governance models and opportunities for schools. However, we would, on the whole, encourage you not to support this bill. And I'll just, rather than get into a lot of the item-by-item things, just two big-picture things. First is the implementation of the new Minnesota Miracle. And reading through the bill, first, I always had that saying going through my head that one legislature can't commit future legislatures to spending commitments. And I know this doesn't kick in until fiscal 2014 and phases in, but I got over one legislature can't commit another legislature. And I just want to mention that K-12 funding is and should be the state's top priority. And it is the state's top priority. It's 39% of our general fund budget, the largest general fund budget item in the state. So when the Minnesota Miracle is fully implemented, about $5 billion new money in a biennium. If you hold things relatively steady, K-12 K-12 will be about 50% of the budget, going from 39% to 50%. And that may be fine. But think of the options then. If you're growing one part of your budget, what does that do to the other parts of the budget? Think of the growth in health and human services. What impact will you have there? Think about the desire to increase funding for early ed, for higher ed, for local government aid. The point is, not that education shouldn't be adequately funded, it's just when you increase it to 50% of the state budget, you're either going to be able to, you're going to have limits on the other areas of your budget, or you're going to have to raise taxes. And again, that would be about $5 billion in a biennium. And we'll have a good discussion this session talking about trying to raise $1.5 billion in the House proposal. Just think of that times three. So again, it's not a concern that education shouldn't be funded. It should be our top priority, and it is. But we would just argue that fully implemented, the new Minnesota miracle is just not sustainable, given our changing demographics and given the other state priorities. The other thing we comment on, and I know we have in the past, so I'll be brief, but is essentially the permanent waiver for any high school student to have to pass a reading or a math minimum competency test for the grad to earn a diploma. When Minnesota first started testing for a high school diploma was the basic skills test, and one of the main reasons for that was to have minimum competency tests to ensure all students are prepared to a certain level in reading and math. We are now prepared under this bill to permanently eliminate that. And again, the question would be, if we had it to ensure all students are achieving at a certain level by repealing it essentially, effectively, what are we saying? We would argue that that's not the right direction to go if we want to continue to close the achievement gaps. And I understand that there are strong commitments in this committee, even Representative Mariani in particular, to a standards-based system for all students, so all students can be prepared to world-class levels. And we appreciate that, and we look forward to continuing to work with the committee and Representative Mariani and others on this. But this basically is a minimum competency test for high school students to ensure that all kids get to certain levels. And we're proposing to do away with that. Again, there are good things in here, and we really appreciate the time and the effort that the chair and committee have put forth to get this bill. But in the end, in the big picture, it increases funding to levels we think will be unsustainable, and it reverses our current policy on minimum competency testing for high school students to assure they all can read and do math at a certain level. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Bartholomew. Mr. Fields. And you are the closer, and we adjourn this meeting at 4:15, so you got that long or less.
I think I should say.
Wait a minute. Ms. Ciccone, are you coming down to testify? Okay, then you've got half of the time because there's one more person, the parents, who we definitely want to hear from. So go ahead, Mr. Field.
My name is Jim Field. I'm the president of Minnesota Independent School Forum. It's a non-religious group of schools that actually is responsible for advocating for all 530 private schools in Minnesota. I want to speak about what Dr. Noel speaks about, page 141. It's cutting out the state support for special needs students and services and transportation. And I'd like to do this and just tell you a quick little story, because I know you've heard all kinds of testimony, and people are working really hard and really tough here, and we appreciate that and the problems you have to face. The private schools in Minnesota with special needs kids are an asset that shouldn't really be destroyed. And so here's a little story that might illustrate that. There's a young man, an African-American young man, when he was in seventh grade, applied for a scholarship at one of the private schools. That summer, before he went into his ninth grade class, he got the scholarship. there was a product or he was shot. And he became paraplegic. And he still, the high school took him in, and he still went to school and still got the scholarship. He didn't have a problem though. Now, by the way, some of you may know him.
He needs you to make this real short.
Right.
We have one more testifier and two more minutes. I asked if there were any more, and nobody raised their hand, but now all of a sudden we have one more.
I didn't have the supporting means to get around school that I worked at, so they scholarship his sister, who went around school. That was when I graduated. He went to the Cafeteria College, got a master's degree. He was probably in a class at the school, the local school he went to, and managed the advertising. My point is that the school system serves these children very well and can go that extra mile because they have a private ability. And we don't want to destroy that system. I think you should use it as an assistant.
Thank you very much, Ms. Ciccone. You are the closer then.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mary Ciccone with Parents United for Public Schools. I just want to make a couple of very quick points. First off, the constitutional mandate for the legislature to sit is to establish a uniform and efficient system of public education. So the idea of 50% for schools does not seem outside of the realm of possibility. Secondly, and I thank Mr. Jeff Ellamy for pointing out the changing demographics. We know that in the 50s, the state of Minnesota was 26th in the nation in per capita income, and today they are 8th. And the major reason was the first Minnesota miracle. We also know that the definition of insanity is to do the same thing over and over again the same way and expect different results. So we thank you very much for first holding the line on ed funding this session, but also for putting HF2 in this bill as a way for us to move past the insanity that we have been experiencing for the last decade. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And member, that's a very nice ending from my viewpoint. But you know what? I like Mr. Bartholomew too. Just a reminder before we adjourn, members, because we are going to be continuously going tomorrow, we have a different room so that we can be there without being moved, and it is in room 5 tomorrow. So I'll see you there at 1:45. We're starting an hour early as well to get a head start because there are some other meetings later on in the evening. 1:45, room 5 tomorrow. The meeting's adjourned.